The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So, thanks for being here, everyone. My name is Gabe Keller-Flores, again, if you came in a little late. I've been a member here for a while. What I want to talk about today is this path of practice, leading to in the direction of freedom from suffering, and how it's a natural path, one that unfolds due to natural causes and conditions. And I think one example of that is that I'll get to maybe towards the end is that, you know, famously the Buddha said he was just interested in suffering and the end of suffering. So very pragmatic, very practical, down to earth teaching. And in particular, in some of the earliest teachings, just a lot of emphasis on, in terms of describing the goal of practice, just kind of describing how a person would behave. So, you know, it's really some, you know, in terms of qualities that you can observe in a person, like someone who is peaceful, who doesn't get engaged in conflict, who isn't proud. And so these sort of kind of really earthy virtues, we could say. And this is what I think makes, has always made this path trustworthy for me, is, you know, in the books that I would read, and especially in the teachers like Mark and other teachers I've had the good fortune to practice with, just this sense, you know, because Buddhism can and does have a lot, there is a lot of teachings, and some of them are quite profound and can be hard to understand. But in terms of, you know, if we're going to evaluate our own practice, or if we're going to evaluate, you know, who is a trustworthy teacher or friend, it's really these, you know, these qualities that we can observe about, does this person seem, you know, like the kind of person that I would want by my side if you know, when there are challenges. So these qualities of compassion, and yeah, so this is in it's coming to mind a teaching. I can't remember all the details, but basically the Buddha saying something like this, like in terms of evaluating or how we can assess, you know, if someone is wise, and it's through their behavior and through who they are as a person. So this is a really I think important point, because yeah, there is a transformation that can happen through mindfulness and through what we see with mindfulness, but it's not a transformation where we get something and hold on to something in terms of like a conceptual understanding. Oh, I'm wise because now I know this secret, and I'm not going to tell you because, you know, then, you know. So just this very deep habit of comparing ourselves to others and even to ourselves. In Buddhism, in Pali, the word the earliest teachings were written down in, this is called mana, which is translated as conceit, but it's not just necessarily thinking we're better than, it's any tendency to conceive of ourselves in relationship to other people or to ourselves. So this can be really predominant even in our spiritual practice. You know, just that ongoing sense that not being good enough, or an ongoing sense of you know, maybe being better, you know, having, well, I've been practicing this many years, gone on this many retreats, had this many insights, and, you know, yeah, I still suffer and get caught up, but at least I'm not, you know, totally, totally lost. This is a form of the mind constructing. It's an important word. Sankhara is a word that's translated as mental constructions or volitional formations. It's a very broad category. It's really, the mind constructing. And we construct a lot. So even these, you know, this conceit, this comparing is one form of construction. And so even with conceit, even conceiving of ourselves as the same as somebody else is also a form of conceit, because we're even, you know, the mind is assuming that that is sort of a useful activity. It's, well, we're about the same, but it's still sort of this construction. So constructions is really most of what we know are the constructions of our mind. And it's kind of a provocative teachings on this, where when we look at how we experience what we call my life, you know, most of what we experience is on this level of construction. And that's not to say it's bad, because that's just how our minds are. We need to construct, we need to interpret things in order to make sense of the world. But we're not constructing we're not blank slates, you know. We're constructing given certain proclivities or conditioning that the mind already has. So when we construct, it's already tinged by our, you know, previous experiences and our desires, our fears. You know, there's a lot of examples of this in the teachings. A classic one is seeing a rope and thinking that it's a snake. So this is an obvious misperception, but you know, things like that, you know, we can understand are happening all the time. Joseph Goldstein, an important teacher in our tradition, I think to illustrate this, said, "The thought of your mother is not your mother." So there's just this difference that it's not that we're saying there isn't an external reality, but we're saying that whatever we can experience is always through our filters, you know. And so we want to be aware of how we're constructing and how it's conditioned. And basically it's conditioned by what's called ignorance. That's sort of the, in a way, the root of suffering. And it's a teacher I'm studying with online, Gil Fronsdahl, another really great teacher out in California, has said that maybe translating this word avijja, which is ignorance, you could also translate it as more actively like ignoring. So like, what is the mind sort of in the habit of ignoring, not seeing? And what's most relevant is that we're not seeing the causes for stress and suffering that the mind is constructing in the present moment. So how the mind is contributing to our own suffering. And this isn't something that we change just through thinking about it or reading teachings. It's really, this is what's called insight, is where through practicing mindfulness, we see something about the way we construct that we hadn't seen clearly before. And this, probably a lot of people here who've been practicing for a while will have had experiences, and it doesn't have to be deep insights into the nature of reality or things we might read about, classic insights, but even just seeing something more clearly about the way our mind, you know, in particular constructs that we weren't quite seeing, you know, just going along through habit can be really liberating. And well, we might describe that with words after the fact and understand it conceptually, but it's really those, what makes those moments of insight liberating and transforming is that it's not just on the level, somebody might tell us, you know, it seems like you're really having a hard time, you know, you're seeing this person in this way that's really kind of narrow. And we might say, yeah, that's probably true. But it isn't until we actually see, oh, my mind is constructing this in this way, and it's stressful, and it's an activity happening here and now. And, you know, there may be some truth. You know, we take some fact or some activity or some perception of some other person and then sort of essentialize them. Oh, they're always this way. But when we see that our mind is sort of constructing this other person and also this relationship that's stressful, you see, oh, this is, my mind is attached to this way of perceiving as if it were an ultimate truth. And again, we're not discounting that there may be some truth there, but we're just seeing that tendency to kind of cling to a concept as ultimately true about whatever it may be, other people, ourselves, the nature of reality. I had this experience recently on a retreat. I was on retreat a few weeks ago at our retreat center and had been experiencing anger throughout the retreat, and it was great, really great to see to see how that anger and the repetitiveness of it, you know, is kind of, that's what's great about retreat. It can be very hard as well, but it's so good to see, you know, when there's repetition, repetitive thoughts like that, it's kind of a sign that the mind is attached and isn't quite seeing, you know, that attachment. And again, like I'll describe in words, you know, kind of what unfolded, but if it's not about the words or the concept, it was about actually seeing. So, you know, there was some thought that was sort of an angry thought about this person that I felt angry with. And in that moment, I really saw how much, in a sense, I believed that story about that person. And and it was less like, oh, that's not true. And it was more like, my mind is like, I can only ever know through my filters, and this is a painful way of constructing. You know, it doesn't mean that I discount maybe some unskillfulness on their part, or, you know, nobody's perfect. But isn't that the case with ourselves, with other people? Like, there's a difference subjectively between understanding that, you know, I could, with this person maybe, I could think, well, yeah, on some level, I can't read their mind, I don't know what it's like to be them, but, you know, can to some degree say, yeah, okay, this is sort of maybe what happened, and different qualities in their mind, yeah, not perfect, not completely skillful. But isn't there a difference between that and, you know, some story of blame, some story of resentment, of, yeah, and then the suffering that comes from that? And the Buddha has these teachings on this that were coming to mind for me during this retreat and really making sense on a level they hadn't before. Something like, for those who carry on sort of with this kind of thinking, they hurt me, they abused me, you know, there will never be peace. You know, I'm paraphrasing here, but just this very clear understanding that sort of, you know, I'm sure most of us, probably all of us, and if not yet, maybe at some point have experienced just, you know, that pain of holding on, that resentment. And I think it's a deep teacher. I'm not saying that that even that's not justified, you know, and that's where we can sort of get into, you know, that can just be more fuel for those kinds of thinking, like, because then we can turn on ourselves, like, oh, I shouldn't be experiencing anger. As opposed to, so it's really a different orientation. So it's not to say that there isn't skill and usefulness in, you know, assessing what's skillful and unskillful, and, you know, speaking up, you know, taking action, whether it's in an interpersonal conflict or something larger, you know, just participating. But, you know, a lot of the Buddha's teachings on how suffering arises, it's really pointing to how our minds are co-creating that experience. And it's a really interesting exploration. And I think that's the attitude, I think, that's actually skillful and that will lead to, you know, actually being interested in this. It's not like, oh, I shouldn't be suffering, and whenever I'm suffering, well, I'm to blame. I'm creating my own suffering. Oh, now on top of suffering, I'm feeling bad that I'm suffering. And this is explicitly not there in the Buddha's most detailed description of how suffering arises, which is often called dependent origination, or we could just say the dependent arising of suffering. There's 12 links. I'm not sure I'll go into all of that. It's one of the most, I'd say, hard to understand, and just, yeah, there's 12 of them. So there's a lot going on there, but nowhere in those links is there an agent. So it's just, the Buddha's describing suffering as a natural arising. So that attitude of being interested in how suffering arises maybe can coexist with, you know, an openness about what should be done about it. You know, both, yeah, if there's something that can be done externally, changing conditions, you know, why wouldn't we do that? But when there isn't anything obvious that can be done to improve the situation, and especially, I'd say, when the mind has sort of grasped some view that I know what the problem is, I know the cause of suffering, you're the cause of my suffering, or I'm the cause of my suffering, you know, that sort of description or understanding of suffering doesn't leave much room, you know, for exploration or learning. It basically only leads to aversion and the desire to either get away from what we perceive as the cause of our suffering, or, you know, in most extreme cases, you know, I'm going to destroy the cause of my suffering, get rid of it in some way. So this is aversion. But if we're interested in how suffering is arising subjectively for us, there may be that attitude of curiosity and interest, I think, is the most helpful attitude of, like, do I need to suffer in order to even participate skillfully in the situation? And might learning something about how I'm suffering, how suffering is arising, actually contribute to me being more skillful in the situation? And in the same way that the Buddha described suffering as a natural arising, not somebody who is creating suffering, but I'll just read these 12 links, and I won't go into them in detail, but even if they don't all make sense, it can maybe give you a picture of how the Buddha talked about this without needing to posit an agent that's making this happen. It's just kind of a conditional unfolding. So like I mentioned, ignorance is the first condition, and dependent on ignorance, there are mental constructions, or volitional formations sort of gets at the fact that these mental constructions are they're sort of like programs, like what to do. So based on ignorance, not understanding the way things are, not seeing how suffering is arising, not really being understanding what's relevant, being caught up in some way, mental constructions and condition, mental constructions condition cognition. So kind of what we cognize, and based on cognition, we cognize name and appearance. So the names of things, me, you, appearance of things, and conditioned by name and appearance, we're sensitive through our six senses. So in Buddhism, there's the five physical senses plus the mind. So we're sensitive in these six ways, but all of that sensitivity isn't just a neutral sensitivity. It's already conditioned by everything that came before. So we're sort of primed to look for certain things or experience what comes through our senses based on sort of already having kind of fears and hopes and, certain conditioning. And here it maybe gets a little bit more concrete. So with six senses, we have contact. So that's just any contact at the six senses, physical sensation, thought, contact. With conditioned by contact, there's feeling. So we feel contact as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Conditioned by feeling, there can arise craving. So craving either to get rid of an unpleasant or to hold on to a pleasant feeling or to ignore an neutral feeling. Craving sort of matures into clinging. So craving sort of, I want that or I don't want that. And clinging is sort of, I'm gonna or I have to. And then that kind of leads on to becoming. So not only like, yes, that's what I have to do, and now I've become that person who has to do that. And then that leads on into birth. So we've really kind of fully been born as the person who has done that. So we've kind of taken a stand. Yes, I'm the person who, needs to do something and needs to put that person in their place. Now I've taken birth. I've said something. Now I've taken birth. Like I'm sort of staking my identity on, this is who I am. I think this is important. And then birth leads to aging and death and all and all of suffering, all the massive suffering. And this is sometimes interpreted literally, but I think in terms of practice, it's sort of having become someone, that's an inherently stressful position, because we have to defend that position, and it may conflict with other people's position, and but we've really taken birth as that person. And then when things change, like they inevitably do, the conditions change, then we suffer because, I thought that this taking birth as this person who was going to put this person in their place was really going to, be a great birth, was really going to lead me, to happiness. And then it turns out it just leads them to, to be further entrenched in their position. And then we've got conflict and suffering. So that's all these aren't determined, so it's not like, and that's good news, that this is a description of how suffering arises, but it's also pointing to the possibility of freedom from suffering, because And this is exactly how the Buddha described this teaching, is that, and this is how, what he described is sort of one of, I believe, one of the ways he described the important insight that led to his awakening was just this deep analysis and understanding of how suffering arises. Oh, if suffering arises this way, then if there's no ignorance, then there's no mental constructions, and on and on. So there's a lot that could be said about that teaching, but I think just in terms of this theme of seeing the path as a natural one, you know, we can see even suffering. Maybe we don't have to take suffering as personally either, because I think that's one thing maybe we can fall into as Buddhists or meditators. You know, we can hear the teachings and think it's that I'm suffering, or I'm causing my own suffering, which, you know, maybe is a useful way to look at it in some moments, but it could also lead to, yeah, like I was mentioning, sort of blaming ourselves. Ajahn Suchito, a British monk, Buddhist monk, he often says that clinging isn't a decision, it's a reflex. You know, so it's really interesting then to, you know, if we're seeing that these are just conditioned processes, then the question is sort of what allows for those to fall away. And one classic sort of, I think there's probably many ways to think about these links and how they don't have to lead on to the next. But one sort of classic way that we can think about how this doesn't have to be a determined, a fatalistic unfolding is in particular with the links around feeling. And this is maybe why feeling is highlighted in the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, to be aware of the pleasantness or the unpleasantness or the neutrality that we're experiencing, so that we could experience contact and the feeling, but maybe that's where things could stop. You know, an unpleasant physical sensation or an unpleasant, you know, mental experience or a pleasant physical sensation, but that reactivity. And again, I don't think this is something we can just make happen. I think a lot of these descriptions of natural processes are just, once we sort of have that information to some degree, and, you know, we can always study this and think about it and see if it makes sense, then it's just those ideas are more there in the background. So just in being mindful, we may be more likely to notice, oh, unpleasant. And then we, without even having to try to make that happen, we could just have the question like, okay, unpleasant, is there craving based on that feeling or isn't there? And maybe just with that curiosity, we might notice, you know, times where there is unpleasantness and yeah, I really don't like this. And times where there's unpleasantness, maybe, you know, in a meditation period, you know, just sitting and we're noticing some unpleasant physical sensation, but maybe there's enough stability of mind or settledness where we have that experience of unpleasantness, but there isn't a lot of craving to get rid of it. It's just unpleasant. And there's another 12-fold list. I don't know if I'll have time to go into it, but this one, just to maybe to introduce this idea that also the process of the mind of the mind being free from suffering is also described as a natural process. So also not something that we do or can make happen just through our willpower, but again something that maybe we can support the conditions for, bring interest to. I think I'll just read this list too, because it's a beautiful list. And it's an interesting one in that it begins with suffering. So this path, this 12-fold list leading to liberation from suffering, begins with suffering. So if you're suffering at all, that's the first step. So it's kind of a very accessible first step. And I find that it makes a lot of sense to me, this path that's about suffering and the end of suffering, it really requires this being real about suffering to begin. If we don't have that, we're kind of, not really starting on the ground, on the right ground, maybe. So based on suffering, or with suffering as a condition, now this again isn't deterministic. It's not that, because suffering can lead to more suffering, but suffering can also lead to confidence or faith. And I think this takes a little bit of thinking about how this would happen, but I think it's because when we're clear about suffering as being relevant, and maybe we also read some teachings or come across some teachings that somebody, like the Buddha, that there's something that can be done about it. It's like there can be some confidence, some faith, even just borrowed confidence or faith, that this is really relevant. Like, if there's something to be done about this, I'm on board. I'm gonna see what can be done. I remember reading the Buddha's teachings on the Four Noble Truths, which are all about suffering and cessation of suffering. And I was maybe 16 or something, and suffering a lot. And just the fact that somebody based their whole, kind of teaching on that very, it was like, these teachings are 2,600 years old, but I knew exactly, at least I thought I did, knew exactly what he was talking about. Like, this is really relevant. This subjective experience of feeling burdened, feeling, ill at ease, feeling stressed, unhappy. This is really relevant. So there was confidence for me immediately, just in the fact that somebody would kind of name this so directly and be kind of pointing to the way that, that there's a way out that's not dependent on external factors. I mean, obviously external factors can have a role in our suffering, but, and even on the path, the path of mindfulness, it's not that external factors don't play a role. That's why we have a meditation center and come together in community and we have teachings. But, just like in that 12-fold list, it's really seeing one, in addition to maybe external conditions that can be sort of the fuel for our clinging and our suffering. And there's also this thorn in the heart, which is one image the Buddha used, this kind of this deep habit we have of clinging that's a condition for suffering. Okay, so back to this list on liberation from suffering. So with suffering as a condition, there can arise confidence or faith. With faith as a condition, there can arise gladness. And so again, I think this one requires a little explanation. And I think it's based on that confidence, we start to show up. We start to practice. We start to practice mindfulness. Start to practice the different teachings, what the Buddha recommended. And that gladness, even just the gladness of applying ourselves, or the, whatever little taste, even just a moment of mindfulness, when we see that that has a skillful effect, even just to sit, like we did earlier, and even just one, two moments of mindfulness where we see, oh, the mind has the capacity of putting down this stressful drama, you know, just chewing on things that aren't helpful, and can be present with our experience in what feels like maybe a new way, in a way that's illuminating more clearly just, the way that we construct things. So anyways, just this gladness, like, and I was thinking that this gladness, it's one way to think of it maybe is this, is gladness that there is goodness, that there is wholesomeness, that there is a path, you know, leading in a good direction, and that it isn't personal in a sense. It's not, it's not about me constructing some idea of myself, which, you know, we probably do a lot, and there can be some gratification there. But to see that this mind, you know, a moment of mindfulness, at least for me, doesn't feel that personal. Doesn't feel like it's, you know, Gabe's moment of mindfulness. It feels like the mind, just the mind's natural capacity to reflect on the way things are and maybe learn something, you know, see, oh, this seems to be leading in a good direction, that doesn't. So just the gladness that there is a direction of goodness, of wholesomeness, however we want to describe that. So with gladness as a condition, there's joy. So I think that's described as, you know, with that first taste of gladness, then like, okay, I'm really gonna commit a little more, or go all in, or like give myself wholeheartedly to whatever that practice might be that's bringing about that gladness. And then there might be joy. And based on joy, then tranquility is the next, which sort of with that joy, which can kind of alleviate a lot of the usual just, you know, suffering that we experience a lot of the time, but to really be kind of giving ourselves to some maybe meditative activity or other wholesome practice and really reaping the benefit. So this may take a while, who knows, depends on probably on each of us, but, you know, just kind of what the effect of that, experiencing that joy and letting that joy in, you know, it's kind of healing. It's healing for the mind and body to experience joy, a joy that's not dependent on external sense experience, but that it's internal, the mind sort of appreciating its own, its own goodness, its own stability. So in kind of the wake of that joy, with the healing and the dispelling of some of our maybe usual kind of modes of suffering and just kind of the legacy of suffering, we could say, in our minds and bodies of being tight, tranquility, sort of, just kind of like less agitation, nowhere to go because the mind is more happy. Based on tranquility, then actually is happiness. So that's sort of not needing to go anywhere, kind of a deeper well-being. And then I think this is an important one, that based on happiness, there's unification of mind, which is often translated as concentration or samadhi. So because the mind is feeling well-being, it doesn't need to go anywhere, and the mind unifies, can settle more deeply. And I think this is an important point because it's describing just this natural progression towards, it goes all the way to liberation, but up to this point to concentration, which if you're a meditator sort of can be a goal. I'm going to be concentrated. But this is really describing that it's happiness that leads to concentration, which makes sense if we think about it. We've probably even had just ordinary moments where we're just feeling happy, at ease in the body and mind, and how much easier it is to just kind of for the mind to unify, be present. So I think that's just a helpful point in terms of, what the conditions are for the mind to unify, which is a really pleasant experience for the mind to be unified. But it comes about because of happiness, which is based on all these previous conditions. So based on unification, with that kind of the power of the mind collected, not dispersed like it usually is, then they're seeing things as they are. So the mind is able to make connections, cause and effect connections. It's just kind of like, it's like a microscope, like with that power. Oh, yeah, just kind of seeing things more clearly, which leads to disenchantment. We see that what we cling to actually isn't worthy of clinging to. We see that it's impermanent. Because it's impermanent, it's unreliable. We see that it doesn't refer, when in our direct experience, it doesn't refer to a self that's sort of grasping or a self that's having that experience. We're seeing things in this more direct kind of moment-to-moment way, which uproots that tendency to be enchanted by our constructions. Well, it's just, you know, from that place of deep subtleness, it's like that tendency to construct is seen as stressful. Well, why would I even need to, kind of hanker after that in the future, or just our usual, very ordinary modes of kind of whipping things up in our mind. So there's some disenchantment with that activity, which then dispassion is next, which is sort of disenchantment is sort of seeing that doesn't really make sense, and dispassion is weakening of that tendency to cling. And from that weakening, there are moments where that tendency to cling ceases, and so then there's liberation, there's freedom from suffering, because suffering relies on that clinging. And then the last and the 12th is knowledge of what's been liberated, of how that liberation has come about, or what isn't happening. So it's interesting that the last step, you know, the 11th step is the freedom from suffering, but the last step is this understanding. Oh, this is how that happened. So I don't pretend to understand all of this, but I think, again, sort of seeing that it's a natural, or in this description that it's a natural process, maybe can inspire some confidence that it's just a matter of fulfilling the conditions. And, you know, for me, and maybe for you, like these aren't ordinary experiences. So it's not that this is necessarily going to happen right away, but just that it's lawful, and that it's just a matter of the right conditions being present in order for this unfolding to happen. And that this unfolding is really, you know, leading in the direction of happiness in all these kind of deepening ways, maybe can be inspiring. It sort of does raise the question with both of these lists, since there isn't an agent in a way posited there, of what we're supposed to do then. But I think this is why this path is a path of wisdom and awareness. It's not a path of necessarily even knowing where we're going. I mean, obviously we have these maps, we can think about it, but in our own direct experience, you know, we have to start where we are. It's not trying to experience something that we've read about, but having these maps, maybe, again, like I was saying, can be information that as we're being aware, we can notice. We might notice. We might notice some confidence arising from our direct experience of suffering and the end of suffering and what we're learning directly. And we might notice gladness just in, you know, in applying ourselves. And so, and we might also notice how suffering arises based on, you know, those different links. So I think, you know, we can often want to just someone to just tell us what to do. But with these descriptions, yeah, it's more like, yeah, things to look out for maybe. And what we're supposed to do, I'd say, is just to do our practice of being mindful. I think it was Munindraji, a teacher for Joseph Goldstein and some of our other teachers, who said something like, to just sit and know you're sitting, and the whole path will unfold from there. So even though, you know, there's a lot of these lists and all of that, in terms of our practice, we're really connecting with what we can know directly in our own experience. And, you know, if we need, because we do want to kind of gauge, are we on the right path or not, we can just kind of look, you know, as I'm being aware, am I being aware in a way that is leading towards more or less suffering? And when we first start to be aware, we might feel like we're suffering more, but it may just be that we're noticing the suffering more. So, yeah, we kind of want to be careful about that. But even when we're knowing suffering, you might be on the lookout for that sense of gladness. Like, with both of these lists, could we be glad, kind of in either case, to be aware of whatever it is that we're aware of, whether what we're aware of is, oh yeah, this is how suffering arises, or what we're aware of is, you know, the gladness that is arising through being mindful. So some of the early teachings, when they're kind of, you know, just to get maybe a little bit, give a little bit more, a little bit more instruction in terms of, well, what should I do in terms of being a practitioner, in terms of how do I apply myself? Some of the earliest teachings, I think it's just interesting to see how they, you know, what they talk about. And again, like I was saying earlier, a lot of it is in these really kind of practical, earthy terms, like just in terms of how we are. Like, if the goal is to be peaceful, if the goal is to be less attached to our cravings, then the practice is really in line with that. It's really like practicing relating to conditions in a peaceful way, practicing, you know, facing or being real with our craving, and you know, seeing that it leads to suffering, or seeing if it's possible to, like in that those links, be with feeling, be with pleasant feeling, without kind of needing to grasp, needing to become the person that grasps, or being with unpleasant, is kind of that forbearance. So really kind of straightforward. So maybe I'll just end by reading a few things that I think point to how maybe we don't need to be constructing a lot, even though the teachings, there's a lot of words there, but in terms of our practice, maybe we don't need to be kind of like constructing a whole lot in order to be practicing in the direction of liberation. Maybe it's in our own direct practice, it's a lot more about kind of seeing how we're constructing, and maybe constructing less and being more interested, less in being the doer, and more in being the person interested in, yeah, what conditions are present. So this is a poem called An Auspicious Day. So this is from the early teachings, translated by Gil Fronsdal. Don't chase the past or long for the future. The past is left behind. The future is not yet reached. Right where it is, have insight into whatever phenomenon is present. Not faltering and not agitated, by knowing it, one develops the mind. Ardently do what should be done today. Who knows? Death may come tomorrow. There is no bargaining with mortality and his great army. Whoever dwells thus ardent, active day and night, is, says the peaceful sage, one who has an auspicious day. So, you know, not a lot of complexity there, not a lot of dependence on elaborate maps or anything, but just this, you know, these very simple instructions around peacefulness, around letting go of the past, the future. In another poem, it says also, don't cling to what's present. Maybe just ending with that, like, maybe, you know, the teachings, we take them in, see how they, you know, what impact they have. But in terms of our direct practice, you know, maybe we just begin where we are and noticing just what we can know directly for ourselves, just how we tend to get caught up and how, you know, how that maybe we work with that in our own direct experience. So kind of, what can we learn? How can we be moving in that direction that liberation from suffering describes? How can we feel for ourselves that gladness of kind of working with the understanding that we have? Being mindful seems to, you know, to be skillful. You know, letting go of craving seems to be skillful. So I'll end there, and we have a few minutes. So yeah, it'd be great to hear if people have any thoughts, like, just on that level, what you're learning in your experience, kind of what's really immediate and practical, that maybe something that's coming to mind that you want to share, or maybe time for a question. So thanks for your kind attention, and any comments or questions.
I'll say, I found a lot of peace during this lecture. Like, I felt it really deeply. And I think it's the simplicity of, like, the Buddhist teaching. And, like, I think a lot, so the simplicity really, really eased me into it. And I've heard it a bunch of times, but I think it's starting to click more and more. This idea that suffering is inherent, because a lot of, like, my problems arise from, like, either saying I caused it, blaming other people, or like saying this isn't right. And the more I've learned about Buddhism, the more I've calmed into, like, it is a natural state. And then the second idea of it's the clinging of the mind. So, like, I like to make proclamations like, I won't do this anymore, or like, okay, I'm being so good this week. And I've realized, like, the faultiness of all that. Mm. And in that, I can, the more I practice quieting down, the more I do, like, simplistic things, like just focusing on my breath or listening to a lecture very diligently, the more calm I've gotten. And then the last thing I want to say is I felt this sense of presence of Buddha, not in a weird way. It's just this, like, energy of, I think it's present in all of us. It's this calm feeling. And I've really, like, admired that. I still go through the whole chaos of, like, I wake up, I go to work, you know, like, I have doubts, I have insecurities. But when I'm really calm, sometimes I look out the window, or I'm listening to a human, there's this, like, really settling peace. And, like, earlier I was laughing really hard when you're like, well, suffering's the start. I was like, oh my God, I'm like, I'm really there. And when I get some moments of peace, I'm like, this feels good too. Yeah.
Really appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, I just maybe just want to underscore what one thing I heard you say, which is sort of like, just kind of the naturalness of, you know, the wholesome states in that list toward liberation, they seem to, in my mind, involve a lot less construction than, you know, the earlier list that leads to suffering. You know, that's like, it's all about kind of this elaboration, this construction, which we're so familiar with, right? That's kind of the world of the mind and thoughts, you know, and getting caught up and becoming and all of that. And so just, I think, just that we're beginning to trust something which is a little bit more open, you know, like, you know, just these, because this list, you know, that leads to liberation, it's not like anyone constructing anything or doing anything. It's more, yeah, just this natural process of kind of refinement and trusting that direction of less construction and peace and, yeah. So I think, I guess maybe my point is like, just, I think it's actually a pretty big shift, because we're so traditionally or just habitually so kind of addicted to thinking that my thoughts, like if I just thought better, like eventually my thoughts will lead me to freedom. So just to like really appreciate a moment of peace, and it's not based on constructing anything, it's actually more, you know, dependent on an absence of construction, it's actually a pretty significant shift of direction. And that's, I think, where that gladness and confidence is coming from. Like, oh, you know, I kind of, this is a different way, and it's trustworthy, maybe precisely because it's not so, yeah, constructed by me, but it's, you know, and this is where, yeah, feelings like maybe a little what you were saying, like it's not like me, not something I've constructed, so we could call that the Buddha, or we can call it the Dharma, but, you know, there's that, the Buddha said, like, his teachings weren't something, like, he came up with. He gives this metaphor of having come across an ancient path to an ancient city and just kind of rediscovering it. So there's that sense of the naturalness, and that we just kind of need to appreciate that, let in that truth. Yeah, this feels good. This feels trustworthy, this peace. And then that's kind of the process where it just keeps deepening. So even if it doesn't make sense, because we can be so wanting to understand everything and to make sense, but to just trust our own direct experience. You know, this is stressful, leading to getting bound up. And this, even just a simple moment, you know, of mindfulness, being present, not denying anything, not pushing anything away, but the mind less invested in needing to kind of nail things down, and the freedom there, you know, letting that in, I think, is what allows us to, yeah, just to keep going, keep being interested in it.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.